Thank you. We're joined this week by Maureen Moakley, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Rhode Island, Brian Amaral from the Boston Globe, and Matt Weldon, Director of Rhode Island's State Department of Labor and Training. Thank you all for joining us. Director Weldon, let's start with the effort to get Rhode Islanders back to work after the pandemic. There's a lot of consternation in some quarters now about what seems to be a shortage of workers. Is Rhode Island facing a labor shortage?
Well, I think it's a national issue, Ian. You know, we've heard from employers throughout the state and industries that range from hospitality to manufacturing and everything else across the board that they're having a hard time getting people to come back to work. You know, we know that the pandemic forced tens of thousands of Rhode Islanders out of the workforce, and a lot of them relied on unemployment insurance and the new pandemic unemployment assistance programs to support themselves and their family throughout the last 14 or 15 months. It's been an incredible challenge. And some of the discussion across the country is that the federal government set benefit levels too high to get people to go back to work. You know, and I don't know if that's the case or not. I think people were, you know, scared or nervous about the health conditions and the safety concerns with the pandemic that we're facing. You know, people were forced out and then had to rely on those benefits. But one thing we wanted to do is think about creative ways to try to get them to go back now that it's safe. And the reality is that everyone that's of working age in Rhode Island can get a vaccine. The vaccine percentage is high. You know, the rollout has gone very well. And so we now at DLT are requiring everyone that's collecting unemployment or pandemic unemployment to start looking for work again because it's safe. And also we're hoping to incentivize that because we worked to change the law a few weeks ago and the assembly moved it very quickly. And that now allows people to earn more money and stay connected to unemployment so they don't fear falling off of that safety net in the event that they don't have the hours they need to support themselves going forward.
How do you expect things to change in the months ahead? And with tourism being one of the state's largest industries, if restaurants and other places are still struggling to find workers, what is the answer?
Well, while the changes that we made are certainly going to help across the board, there's no secret that the driver was Rhode Island summer tourism situation. You know, we know that restaurants need to be able to staff their operations during the summer months here in Rhode Island. That's why we work so quickly. And the assembly moved that bill very fast. I've been working in the assembly in various capacities for 22 sessions. That's one of the quickest bills that I remember passing. And it passed for good reason. We think it's going to save the unemployment trust fund money, and it's going to help people transition back into the workforce. You know, changing human behavior is hard. Making people know that it's safe and it's okay to go back to work is a difficult message to send, but we're trying to send it every day. We're going to be tracking how many people collect every week, how many of those people report partial earnings, meaning they're working again. And we want to see people transition back because in September, the federal programs end. And if they're not continued, we're going to see a lot of Rhode Island families without.
Let's go to Brian.
Director Weldon, Rhode Island was one of the first states into the Great Recession, one of the last states out of it. And actually, we never really recovered the labor force that we had. Even pre-pandemic, we had fewer people in the labor force than we did before the Great Recession. How do we stop history from repeating itself here and Rhode Island being sort of straggling behind some of its New England peers?
You know, Brian, part of that is in all the work that we've done to help with sector-based, demand-driven workforce training. You know, we used to hear a lot about a skills shortage. You know, we haven't had a lot of those discussions in the last year, but certainly before that we did. In the last administration, we flipped the model on workforce development. And instead of what is commonly known as a train and pray program, where you essentially train the supply side and hope that people hire them, you know, we went and invested in industries and let the industries make the decisions and develop their own training. And we made investments that would help people get connected to meaningful careers. And we came a long way. The program was very popular, and it Real Jobs Rhode Island and its sister programs, and it's done very well. We're going to need to continue to rely on that model and Back to Work Rhode Island, which using CARES Act money was Real Jobs with a hug, I call it, because it's, you know, a lot of people were facing challenges and Back to Work allowed us to address some of those ancillary needs while getting people back. And what I mean is if someone's car needed to get repaired so they can go to work, if they were behind on some bills, we could help them out a little bit with that CARES Act money and get people in a good solid place with the economy. You know, Rhode Island's unemployment rate last month dropped 0.7 of a point down to 6.3%. We're ahead of Mass and Connecticut. We're just about at the New England average of 6.2% and the U.S. rate of 6.1%. We're in the game right now, Brian. I think we're going to stay on the front end of that curve.
Let's go to Maureen.
I'd like to ask about fraudulent unemployment claims. Why is the department so reluctant to give out numbers about the number of fraudulent unemployment claims? Don't we want to have a perspective on this? Don't we want to know relative to other states in the nation how we fare along these lines? Why aren't they forthcoming on this information?
Well, you know, Maureen, the previous department, the previous administration and the former director didn't give that information out. I was named acting director, I think, on February 22nd or 23rd. I announced that week that I would release that information, and we released all the fraud data within 2 weeks.
Okay.
We've done that. I know that that information is important for people to know. You know, I agree with the decision before not to release that at the time, because we were facing the greatest challenge that we've had in fraud across the country with the introduction of these new programs. And unemployment wasn't the only program that got hit. The PPP programs, other federal incentives were all attacked. They're very well organized, and we didn't want to tip our hand at that time. When I got this position and now I'm in a permanent role, I knew that it was important to let people know what we were facing and to let them know they weren't alone. I did release that information. I'll continue to update it as it's available.
How do we stand relative to other states?
When I announced it in March, it was early March, and we said we had paid out about $247 million in suspected or confirmed fraud. Suspected fraud is fraud that claims that we've stopped because they have fraud indicators on them and no one has lifted the stop. Confirmed fraud has a victim behind it. So I'm a fraud victim. The state said that I filed a claim. I knew I didn't file a claim. There's a person behind that. That's confirmed. That confirmed fraud number has risen by about 10 million since that time. And that's largely because of the tax documents we sent out. And the first time some people became aware that there were claims filed in their name. You know, our numbers now, we're probably getting closer to $300 million in fraud paid out. We paid $3.3 billion in benefits. I think as a percentage, we're right there with the rest of the country. There's not a single state that didn't run into these issues.
Director Weldon, back in 2016, Donald Trump described himself as the champion of forgotten Americans, people who have been left behind by the economy. We know that wages have been largely stagnant in America for decades. Are the forgotten workers or non-workers referred on your radar screen, and what can your department do to try and help them to find their way back into a better place in the economy?
Well, absolutely. And those workforce programs that I talked about before were really aimed at getting people that were maybe underemployed, not just unemployed, and putting them on a pathway to good, solid paying jobs that could support them and their families. That's a key focus of mine, is to also reach into communities that have largely been looked over in the past and to give people good opportunities with, you know, solid Rhode Island employers. And when I talk to employers that we've funded every year or in the past through our workforce programs, I tell them there are two things I'd like to see when making decisions going forward. One is I want to see a tangible. I want someone to either get a new opportunity or get an increase in pay or get some kind of a stackable credential that will help them down the road. Two, I want to know what they're doing about diversity and inclusion. Does everyone that works for them look like me, or do they go into communities and give people opportunities? And I've been very happy to hear that our employers in Rhode Island want to champion this. They want to be a partner, and I'm looking forward to working with them on that.
Let's go to Maureen.
I'd like to ask you about the success of technical training programs. How successful are they in training workers like plumbers or electricians? For the consumer, try to get a plumber or an electrician, and when they come, the rates are really high. Do you think that with all the emphasis on college education, there's some sort of a stigma for young people to go into these fields?
I think, especially in my generation, people were told it was college. And unless you had a family member that was in the trades, that wasn't even something you really pursued. I think that's starting to change. Years ago, I had the opportunity to attend the local plumbers and pipe fitters hall on an apprenticeship recognition day with former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, who said that apprenticeship is the key to the future for a lot of people, the key to middle-class jobs, to work in the building trades, and in particular, the licensed trades, where people can make a solid income without having gone through college. And in fact, apprenticeship is like a college education without the student debt. And that was what, you know, Secretary Perez used to say. And it's true. We champion apprenticeship here as much as we can. Apprenticeship has been around for hundreds of years. It's the single best career pathway that there is. We think that we should get as many young people into the trades as possible because it does put them on a pathway to good, solid paying jobs.
Let's go to Brian.
The work search requirement is obviously still pretty fresh. It's still pretty new. But do you think it has caused, since it's been announced, do you think it's caused more people to start looking for work? And what are you hearing from claimants about this new requirement that they search for work while on unemployment?
So, yes, I think it's absolutely causing people to take it seriously and to look for work. And we've been communicating with our claimants to let them know this is a real thing and you have to do it and it's good for you. Because I am very concerned personally about what happens to Rhode Islanders come September 4th. And we're telling people we need to get you reconnected to the economy now. So be looking for at least 3 jobs a week. You know, we have a virtual career center on backtoworkra.com, and enrollments on the virtual career center have gone up 900% since we announced that the work search was required. We are linking people to our services. We're letting them know, you know, these jobs are available and it's your obligation to look for a suitable job and take one if it's offered. We're doing a lot of work. People are taking it seriously. I hope that they understand it's not punitive. We really want to get people back to work to help them.
One of the things that we hear a lot from people who might be on unemployment and have been in, say, for example, the restaurant industry is, you know, the reason I don't want to go back is because of work conditions. The pay isn't great. How do we improve the working lives of working people so that they are more eager to get back into the workforce?
Well, I think that the law that we just changed, which allows people to earn more money right now while they're collecting, will help them. I think it'll let them know that they do have a safety net. And that means that they, and like the governor said, let's put that federal $300 to work for Rhode Island and let's maximize Rhode Island working families' income. That's step one. Step two is right now it's a job seeker market, Brian. And so employers are going to have to pay attractive rates with benefit packages that make sense, or people are going to go work somewhere else. And so the government can only do so much. I made an analogy about a bus. And I said, you know, our job is to make sure there's fuel in that bus, make sure there are no potholes along the way, and make sure that it's a smooth ride. But we're not driving it, right? And claimants have to drive it together and get on that bus with their employers and work out how they're going to work together going forward.
Director Welton, how does the effect of automation compare with the offshoring of jobs on the effect of workers in Rhode Island? And with these kind of sweeping changes, what can be done to help address those who are impacted?
One of the reasons in the Great Recession that we were hit so bad is because Rhode Island was a manufacturing hub for so long, and manufacturing changed. And that's probably the best example of how we'll move out of this pandemic as well. You know, manufacturing went from working in the machine shop and on the floor. I did that in the summer in college, and I know exactly what it was like, to then the CNC operations. It's all computer driven. It's fascinating. My son had the chance to do a summer internship in a manufacturing plant and now is a mechanical engineering student at URI, my alma mater. And you know, it's because he was interested in what he was doing. I think coming out of the pandemic, we're going to see more opportunities where people work either virtually or with more technology. Our job is to help make sure we can provide the training and the programs to put people on a pathway to those jobs and to help the economy adjust as we go forward.
Just one final question. I believe the governor's workforce board has temporary leadership right now. What are the plans for permanent leadership there?
They do. They have temporary leadership and have for a short time. The job was posted and candidates applied, and they will be interviewed over the next couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to getting somebody in that role and to working with them going forward.
And I have to ask you, will the Red Sox be in first place in the American League East on September 1st?
Absolutely. And despite what our friend Lou DePalma says, it's, you know, this is Red Sox country. So let's go Sox.
All right. That's Senator Lou DePalma, the Yankee fan from Middletown. Thanks so much for joining us, Maureen.
Thank you.
Brian Amaral from the Boston Globe.
Thank you, Ann.
And the director of Rhode Island State Department of Labor and Training, Matt Welton.
Thank you very much.
As usual, you can find a lot more on our website at thepublicsradio.org. I'm Ian Donis.